X-Talks connects professionals in the life science, medical device, and food industries with useful content like webinars, job openings, articles, and virtual meetings to help you succeed in your career. This Life Science Focus podcast brings together some of our editorial staff to share insights into the latest B2B industry news to keep you up to date.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the X-Talks Life Science Podcast. I'm Sarah Hand, Editor-in-Chief at xtalks.com, and this week I'm joined by a very special guest, Juliana M. Reed, the Executive Director of the Biosimilars Forum. The Biosimilars Forum was incorporated in Washington, D.C. as a nonprofit organization to advance biosimilars in the United States with the intent of expanding access and availability of biological medicines and improving healthcare. Julie was appointed as the executive director of the Biosimilars Forum in January of 2022 after serving as the president for more than 8 years and having been one of its original co-founders. She has more than 30 years of experience in the healthcare sector and has served in executive roles leading global corporate and government affairs for Pfizer, Hospira, and Coherus Biosciences. Julie, thanks for joining me on the podcast today.
Oh, thanks, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
So as one of the co-founders, can you tell me about the overall mission of the Biosimilars Forum and what prompted you to start the organization in 2013?
Yeah, I'm dating myself, so making me feel a little old that it's been that long. But it's an incredible story. And back then in 2013, when we started, we had all just our members, our founding members, many of who are still with us from the beginning, they were the members of the industry, of the pharmaceutical industry, that committed to creating and developing biosimilars and committed to bringing lower cost biosimilars to the patients and to taxpayers who needed them. And we recognized, especially in Washington, D.C. back then, that one, we were creating an entirely new industry here in the U.S. And it was not a brand drug industry, and it was not a generic drug industry. It was unique. It needed a unique voice, a separate voice from what was going on in Washington, where it's small molecule generic industry or the brand industry. And that the Biosimilars Forum, we created it so that members came to the table with a unique focus on biosimilars. And so one of the key things we did is we spent almost 2 years just developing the forum and getting our founding member companies. And why one of the reasons we're called the forum is we were a forum to discuss policy and to create new policy that did not have the old traditional generic positions or the old traditional brand or pharma positions on things. All things biosimilar. So it was, and we continue to have that position and that culture and that thought process of we have to look at biosimilars uniquely and differently because they are different from both sides of what was the model back when we started. And then we, like you said, we've been around for, it'll be close to 9 years or 10 years soon. So that's what we did. Everybody had to come in and put a biosimilar hat on and leave their generic hat outside the door and leave their pharma brand hat outside the door. So it's been quite an adventure and an incredible success.
Wow, definitely filling an unmet need there. It is a different kind of space than what we had seen before.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, if you think about it, back in 2013, we were building an industry from scratch, mm-hmm. and including creating a program at the FDA and working with the FDA and Congress to fund the program at the FDA. So again, an incredible opportunity for all of us.
Wow. And so talking about then where we've come in that time in terms of the uptake of the biosimilars that now are on the market, a few weeks ago, I had a discussion with Dr. Jillian Willett from Samsung Bioepis. We'll link that episode in the show notes for our listeners who haven't heard it yet. But one of the things we discussed was the company's first U.S. biosimilar market report. And one of the most interesting findings is that despite their potential for offering cost savings, some biosimilars have failed to gain even, you know, half of the market share for a given indication. So could you shed some light on the challenges right now of biosimilar uptake?
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you were able to talk to Jillian. She's been with the biosimilars industry from the beginning and is such a great thought leader. So I'm so glad you talked with her. But yeah, in their report and several reports show the challenges. And let's talk about the successes first. Biosimilars in the oncology marketplace are doing very well. Mm. And we see good uptake. And that's because oncology has had programs that incentivize the uptake of biosimilars. And so what we know is incentives work. And so in oncology, that medical field has the largest number of biosimilars. And when you talk to oncologists, they will tell you, we are so grateful to have lower cost medicines for our patients. We're able to treat more patients. We're able to give our patients more medicines that are innovative as well, because we have cost savings from biosimilars. So the model is working in oncology. The challenges are outside of oncology where there are not incentives. There's perverse incentives. And that is in rheumatology and in other spaces where physicians, A, may not be incentivized to use a lower cost medicine because of the reimbursement rules. We are pleased. One of the key accomplishments last year for the forum was that Medicare, Congress approved that Medicare could give a bump in reimbursement for physicians in the Medicare Part B space, because again, the way the reimbursement model works in Medicare is physicians are unfortunately incentivized to use a higher cost medicine versus a lower cost, unless they are in something like oncology is, which is the oncology care model. But really what we're seeing, the greatest barrier that we're seeing, and this is a significant concern, especially this year with the Humira biosimilar launches, It is going back in time. It is the PBMs, the pharmacy benefit managers are blocking the access to the lower cost biosimilar. And it is happening now in real time. And we have the data on what the biosimilar uptake is across every biosimilar since the first one launched in 2015. And what is happening is the access to the biosimilar is controlled by the pharmacy benefit manager. The PBMs prefer a high cost, high rebated product medicine. So we have seen, and this is especially true in the infliximab space from the beginning, where the infliximab, they were some of the first biosimilars to launch in the inflammatory space, in the inflammatory and immunology space, they were blocked by the PBMs who preferred the high rebate, high list price product. And so the PBMs will have either that preference or they will prefer and they will sign exclusionary contracts. So we continue to see this behavior by the PBMs where they are blocking access to lower cost biosimilars they're only preferring the high cost or high WAC, high rebate, because they get the rebate, that's their revenue stream. And that is the biosimilar, if that any biosimilar is on the formulary, it's the high WAC, high list price product and high rebate. What that is doing is it's limiting uptake. It's limiting, though, significantly limiting out-of-pocket savings. Mm-hmm. So imagine you have your insurance and you have an out-of-pocket that you have to pay every year for, and this is happening right now today with a number of the Humira biosimilars. 2 weeks ago, we launched 7 Humira biosimilars, boom, and all in 1 week. We have the data that shows the PBMs prefer the high WAC, high rebate, but Humira biosimilar. And those products are the only ones that are getting any uptake. Hmm. What is interesting, though, is our members and other biosimilar manufacturers, especially in Humira, are launching with 2 list prices, the same product. One's the high WAC. The other price structure they are launching with is a low WAC. I'll give you an example. Amgen launched the first Humira biosimilar, and congratulations to them. They launched in the spring. They launched with two prices. Mm. One high rebate, high WAC, and the other low rebate, low list, low WAC, all the same. One is only a close to 5% discount from Humira, the brand, and the other one is close to 85% discount.
Wow.
If you're in any of the 3 PBMs that control 80% of the market as a patient, you would think, wow, 85% on a product that is tens of thousands of dollars a year, I could save a ton of money. Well, guess what? You don't get access to that one.
Wow.
The only one you're going to get is the high rebate, and you're going to have to pay your out-of-pocket. And we have several companies that are doing the same thing. We even have one company that said, oh, no, we're not doing that. That's not the right thing to do. And they launched and they bypassed the PBMs and went right to Mark Cuban's new pharmacy.
Ah.
So this last 2 weeks is what we've called over the past year, preparing everyone, is what we call a watershed moment for the biosimilars industry. And it really, really is. There's 8 Humira biosimilars on the market right now. There is over $130 billion that could be saved in the next few years. But if the only thing that the PBMs are giving access to is a high rebate, high WAC, we're not going to see that cost savings. Mm. And we're also seeing that even Medicare, which is, you know, like just... For me, it continues to just be, wait a minute, I don't get it. Medicare does not require that Medicare beneficiaries get access to the low WAC biosimilar. So Medicare is not overseeing their PBMs and requiring that they achieve cost savings through biosimilars. They're not promoting biosimilars. But Medicare is one of our lowest, has one of the lowest access or lowest uptake of biosimilars.
Wow.
So it's, and I say this because we have the data, it is what's happening. And when we, you know, you asked, we're probably still on our first question, but when you asked about the forum, the people, when our members went out to create biosimilars and pass the BPCIA law, and we had the support of Congress, the PBM model was different 15 years ago. That and the PBM stood side by side with us in the largest employers in this country and said, we need free market competition in the biologic space. The biologic space is the space that has the fewest number of prescriptions, yet almost 50% of Medicare's prescription drug spent is for that very small number of biologic medicines. So Medicare had has a huge opportunity to create savings. The PBMs supported low cost, okay? They were one of the, and the employers supported lower cost medicines. They wanted the competition. Since then, the PBM's model has changed where they don't prefer a lower cost product. They prefer a high cost, high WAC, high rebated product. So
if the problem is more so the PBMs than, let's say, a reluctance to prescribe biosimilars on the part of the physicians themselves, whether due to reluctance or to the rebates that they are getting, what do you see as the solution here then to changing this?
Sure. I think there's a number of different things. Number one, in what we're very honored to see and pleased to see is that employers are driving change. We work with several of the largest employer associations and the National Consumer League. So if you consider, we work with an organization called the National Alliance of Healthcare Purchasers Coalition, and they represent 45 million employees around the country. And the National Consumer League, who represent all consumers, so in this country, they are all demanding access to the lower cost biosimilars. Hopefully that'll help raise the awareness at the PBMs that they need to change their model to help support this. But Congress is also looking at it, right? Yeah. The PBM bills are being introduced by both the Senate Health Committee and the Senate Finance Committee. Several of them have provisions for transparency. I'd have to say that I think biosimilars are the role model for transparency because we're telling you right now, and we have the data, the high rebate product is what gets access, and we have a low rebate product that is not getting access and not getting uptake. We've already created transparency to a point. More needs to be done on that. But also, we have to see PBM models change, okay? And this is going to be a significant outcome if it happens, but change where they, again, are, supporting uptake of lower cost products, supporting competition, not having exclusionary contracts. One of the hardest things to overcome on that, though, is, when the CBO needs to score that, the three big PBMs who control 80% of the market are vertically integrated. And so if you reduce the rebate, what they're able to do because of vertical integration is increase the premium. So that the Federal Trade Commission is looking at all of that, but it's a significant barrier the way that they are, the way their business model works, the significant barrier to cost savings for taxpayers because of everything I just outlined. So biosimilars are the example of what is really happening and relieving costs, relieving savings on the table because of this model.
I'm wondering, could you shed some light on biosimilar uptake in European markets and, how that compares to the U.S.? Is there anything that we can learn from their approach?
Absolutely. And I'm glad you, and we can share some reports with you from IQVIA after this.
Great.
What we saw, and this is what's so important. Now, everyone will say, well, the model is different in Europe, so you can't compare. But I will compare the ecosystem and the stakeholders and what the behavior changes were, because I think that's one of the most important things. It's not about necessarily the model. It's about the commitment across the ecosystem that various stakeholders make. And so to answer your question, the uptake of biosimilars in Europe is much better than here in the US. And what happened was that the rest of the stakeholders, so our members, and you mentioned with the forum is the sole voice for the biosimilars industry in the US.
Wow.
And we're independent. As I mentioned, when we started, we only focus on biosimilars. Everyone leaves their, you know, biases from a generic world or a pharma world outside the door. So we focus on what's best for biosimilars. Our members represent the companies in the US with the most biosimilars under development at the FDA, and the largest number of biosimilars on the market today. So they have the experience. And they're committed to biosimilars. They're committed, you know, it takes 8 to 10 years to develop a biosimilar, over a couple hundred millions. It's a massive commitment. And one of the key things is they also, though, have world leadership in biosimilars. Mm-hmm. Some of our companies have launched in over 80 countries. So when the forum talks, we represent the biggest companies and with the, you know, the most global experience in biosimilars. And what we saw in Europe and in other countries is that the stakeholders within the ecosystem stepped up. We stepped up to spend all that money and all those years developing a lower cost biosimilar. What we saw in Europe is the governments stepped up and they prefer biosimilars. They gave access to biosimilars. They also incentivized their medical groups and their hospitals and everyone else to use the lower cost biosimilars. The UK did a great job with this. They created a shared savings model, which is also a bit similar to what we see in Medicare's oncology model. And that's why one of the reasons oncology has the largest uptake of biosimilars. The physicians were encouraged, and the hospitals in the UK were encouraged to use biosimilars. And what the government did was share the cost savings back to the hospital groups and back to the physician groups and said, okay, you saved, you know, X number of dollars. We're going to give you some of that money back and you can invest it in whatever way you want into resources. So you saw hospitals hire more nurses for education. You saw physician practices hire more nurses. That was an incentive. And it was a mutual, support for both providers and the government, the payer, to support uptake and get the cost savings. So Europe has done great models. There's a high degree of competition in Europe and a high degree of cost savings. So in the US, we could do a lot better.
Certainly a lot to learn there then.
Yeah.
So moving along then to this issue of interchangeability. So that's another thing I got to speak about in my interview with Dr. Wollett. And, you know, she explained that it's in most cases actually not a relevant designation for a lot of patients, given that most biologic medicines are administered by the prescribing physician anyway, as opposed to a pharmacist. But that it could block access to biosimilars for some patients if physicians don't have an understanding of what this designation really means. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this, if you agree with this, and do you think that this designation is really or should be required in the future by the FDA? Do you think it's still a necessary designation?
So I'll tell you what the FDA will tell you. And happy to, you know, it'd be great for you to do a podcast with Dr. Yim, who's the head of OTBB at the FDA. Interchangeability is a statutory requirement within the BPCIA. And it is there because when we were working to get the law passed, the question came up. And Dr. Woollett, Jillian is totally correct. The question came up is, well, what if one of these biologic medicines were ever, what if 20 years from now, 30 years from now, 40 years from now, what if a patient could get their biosimilar biologic medicine at the pharmacy counter? And so what would we do? Because, you know, that means the pharmacist could substitute. Mm-hmm. And so it was, you know, it was put into the law so that we could address potential for retail pharmacists to be able to do automatic substitution. It was answering a what if question for the future. It is not relevant. If you look at back in hindsight, it's not relevant at this stage or possibly into the future for biosimilars or biologic medicines, period. Jillian is right, that they are administered through infusion or injection. They're highly complex, and patients are getting these treatments either through they're getting them through specialty pharmacy, or they're getting them in their doctor's office or in a clinic. And so interchangeability, or the ability for a pharmacist to dispense and do automatic substitution, is not happening. It's not a clinical designation. It's not a scientific designation. It's strictly there in order to allow sometime in the future, if there is a biosimilar going to be developed, that the reference is automatically dispensed at a retail pharmacy, the biosimilar too could be dispensed at the retail pharmacy. Right now, that is not really relevant with the current biosimilars or biologics on the marketplace.
Great. That's great to have you. That's really, what Jillian had expressed as well, and was certainly something new for me to hear. I know a lot of what I've read and written about has been this, you know, promise of interchangeability and how much of a difference that could make to uptake. But then to hear you both say, you know, really, that's not really the issue we're looking at. I think that's an important clarification for people to know. Yeah.
It creates more confusion, mm-hmm. which, you know, we're fighting. The forum is always monitoring for misinformation, mm-hmm. and talking about interchangeability creates more confusion and everything else. So yeah, we're trying hard. FDA is doing a good job, you know, trying to explain it as well, but it's a very difficult thing to explain to folks. So, yeah.
Anything else you'd like to tell me about the work that you do at the Biosimilars Forum?
Sure. So the forum, as I mentioned, we, you know, our member companies are just, you know, it's an honor for me after all this time to be, you know, representing all the, you know, the great companies we have. I think what's real important is, you know, our goals and our mission is our education and creating access and competition to lower cost biosimilars. And so many things go into that. We have, you know, I think we have good relationships with the administrations, you know, in the past and the current. And we have, you know, good relations on the Hill and also with the agencies, because they know that we are building something brand new, and our members are committed to biosimilars. And that's a significant commitment. Some of the other things we work on, not just, you know, educating folks about the barriers to the market and everything else, are we work quite a bit on patient advocacy and education, working with, you know, when I talk about the ecosystem, we need, you know, it takes a village. We need a lot of support from a number of different stakeholders. So we work with employers, we work with Congress, the FDA, Medicare, everyone to say, this is the unique perspective of the biosimilars industry on this policy, or we're here to educate you, you know, patient group, and we bring the FDA with us when we do education. Every time a new biosimilar is launched, if it's in a new therapeutic area, so we've been, you know, we've had biosimilars in oncology, we've had biosimilars in rheumatology, we're seeing the insulin biosimilars launch, that's a whole new patient group, we're seeing the ophthalmology biosimilars launched. Every time a new one is launched in a new therapy, we have to do education. It's you know, and we have to do it from the ground up. And so we get out there and we do that. And again, we're, the FDA is a great partner on that. Best to have the FDA do the education with the physician groups and everyone, because they're the authority. One of the other pieces I think we are working on is we definitely need, you know, and you're following it, the Inflation Reduction Act. The CMS has put out their first guidance just for 2026. We have to continue to work with them to get changes in the IRA for the Medicare, the biosimilar special rule. And we're hopeful that, you know, they will continue to work with us to change the guidance moving forward, because right now it's not workable, you know, for future biosimilars and future negotiations. And I think that the IRA is a good with special rule is a great example of Congress's support for biosimilar competition. We were able to get a two-year delay. We need a longer delay. Okay, 2 years is not enough. It doesn't reflect the biosimilar development and launch, because you need the biosimilar on the marketplace, and the current delay just needs is only 2 years. We still won't be able to launch because of some of the timing factors for the patents. So we need to fix that. We're hopeful, you know, to do that, because biosimilar competition will allow an innovator to not be negotiated by Medicare. And it's much better if you have a biosimilar in the marketplace that you're competing against versus Medicare negotiations. So we're very happy that it's in there. We believe we're going to be able to get some fixes done. We're grateful to CMS for what they're trying to do. I think somebody said the other day in a meeting, they're building the plane and flying it at the same time. FDA, globally, as I mentioned earlier, our members have the largest portfolios on the market, decades of experience now, and the largest number of biosimilars in development. They also, as I mentioned, have launched in over, have approvals and launches in over 80 countries. Their experience over these past number of years and across all those countries, we have new scientific experience and new tools. And one of the key things is that we need to start to streamline the development of biosimilars. Taking 8 to 10 years to develop a biosimilar is too long. And so we have to reevaluate the tools and our experiences and work with the FDA and other regulatory agencies around the world to say, what is the best path forward? What is the most efficient path forward? What's the safest path, safest and scientific path forward? What have we learned and what can we change? And I think that's one of our other big initiatives. We've got a lot going on.
So. Definitely. Well, Julie, thank you so much for your time today, telling me all about your work at the Biosimilars Forum. That's the end of this episode of the Life Science Podcast. If you like today's show, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Thanks, everyone, and see you next week for another episode.
Thanks, Sarah.
thanks for listening to the X-Talks Life Science Podcast. If you enjoyed our discussions today, please share the episode with your friends and colleagues, and be sure to subscribe in order to be notified when a new episode is released. To join in on the discussion, you can find X-Talks on social media, email podcast@xtalks.com, or comment on the articles directly. Links are in the show description. Take a moment to join our community at xtalks.com to get access to everything we have to offer, including webinars, job listings, virtual meetings, articles, and more. The views and opinions expressed in the podcast are those of the speakers sharing them. They should not be taken as professional advice and do not necessarily reflect the policy or position Honeycomb Worldwide. For further information, email us at podcast@xtalks.com. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week.